We have a really big show for you tonight, and it includes Topo Gigi. No, I'm going to introduce my fellow panelists from my far left to my nearest right, not necessarily politically. Starting at the far left is Matt Marsden, who's been a Republican political consultant for a number of folks, including Joe Schwartz, a former congressman, and he can tell you more about himself. You want to do? Yeah, give us a little. Give us.
You're gonna throw me under the fire, Hunter. Like, do a bio.
Like long walks on the
right,
beach.
Exactly. Dogs chasing balls. No, we run a company called Rev6 Data Systems that does political consulting. I've served Congressman Joe Schwartz. I've worked for President George W. Bush. I've worked for two Senate majority leaders in the Republican Senate, decided at some point it was time to pivot to doing more technical data-related consulting, and that's what Rev6 Data Systems does now.
Wonderful. Nick? I'd clap, but I have to hold the microphone, and that's too technically complicated for me.
You just don't want to clap for me.
Next to him is Rick Pluta, who is the intellectual power of Lansing, and who knows everything about what's going on in Lansing. He covers Lansing for Michigan Radio and some other folks, and he's a state institution. Engler closed the rest of the state institutions, but we still got Rick. And next to him is a woman who started as my intern and now is my boss, Zoe Clark, who's the program director of Michigan Radio and to whom we all deservedly take a back seat. So, so I was listening to Michigan Radio yesterday and I realized I found out this is an election year. And I'm going to start. What I'm doing is going to ask my fellow panelists a few questions, and then we'd like to turn it over to the crowd. And we may have some back and forth, and we'll try to behave ourselves. You'll notice there are no sharp instruments up here on the table. So I'm going to begin. Other than the panel, that's right. Other than the panel, with exception of me. I've just come from Toledo, so you have to make allowances. So anyway, I want to start. I'm going to start with Zoe, just sort of ladies first and antiquated chivalry. What is the one thing you're watching most out of this election year?
Oh, okay. So, I mean, I think you can't not talk about 2016 and what it's meant for Michigan and for the country and, you know, what will have been 2 years if we can actually believe that November will be 2 years from November 2016, and whether or not we see a giant wave that would, some indications would show that's what we're going to see towards the Democrats.
Rick?
It's hard to, you know, boil it down to one thing.
But, I did.
No, you actually did at least two. Whether or not this is going to be a wave, whether or not the standard metrics of politics apply as far as what happens to the party in the White House and the party that's in the majority in Washington apply here. And then also, yes, I'm wedging in one more, whether or not the Democrats solve their turnout problem in this particular cycle.
Matt.
I think that what we're most looking at is the number of retirements in the United States Congress over the disaffection with Trump and what that impact is going to be in terms of flipping the Congress in the House and particularly the Senate on a state level. The same sort of applies, and I'm hoping very much to see that this movement that we saw yesterday in Lansing of the female voters that are out there that are recognizing that they need to. Can that movement continue? Can they continue that momentum? And how will it impact the demographical turnouts in an election year? To me, those are the most fascinating things, because if they can sustain that, they will have sustained that momentum for 2 years, which, politically speaking, is not the easiest thing to do.
Great. All right. We'll go, since I have problems with complicated mathematics, we'll just start again and go the other way. Matt, what to you is the most interesting race this year, of all the races, both for people? I mean, we're going to have all new state office holders at the top of the ticket, most of the state Senate, big chunk of the House. What are you looking at the most?
I think that I'm going to watch Congressman Bishop's seat I think that's one that, you know, it needs to keep one to keep an eye on. I think the trot seat is an interesting one to watch. I think that if the Democratic Party chooses to put an all-female slate up with Gretchen Whitmer and an AG candidate that's female and a Secretary of State candidate that's a female versus Bill Schuette or Callie or the rocket scientist Colbeck, Senator Colbeck, I'm sorry. You know, in a primary, who comes out of that will be interesting. But there are a couple critical races, and I think that it's Bishop and Trott in terms of how that swings and what that does and what that sends a message largely nationally in terms of the change in the House.
That's a political consultant. I asked him to name one thing, and he named 45. Rick.
And then he charged you points for TV ad placement.
I wish.
Give him any ideas.
I think that Matt's picks are pretty intriguing because the trot seat will be an indication of what happens when there's a vacancy and it's a straight up, you know, kind of party to party competition. Mike Bishop will be an indication of whether or not incumbents around the country are in trouble. Obviously, my biggest interest is the governor's race because that's what I cover on a day-to-day basis. And that will also be It's interesting on a couple of levels because it's almost like the Rick Snyder version of Republicanism versus the Donald Trump version of Republicans writ large. But it is also going to be something of when you look at the players within the campaigns, and Matt will correct me if I'm wrong, and quickly if experience
Never.
Is any guide. That it's also kind of a proxy fight of Kasich versus Trump in 2020.
Yeah, I think what it's going to come down to is that you saw that a lot of people sat on the sidelines, especially from a voter demographic standpoint. And there are people out there that if you ask them and they honestly answer the question, either they didn't vote in 16 or they did vote and they would wish they could take that back a little bit or they've changed their opinion. And it's really hard in an off-presidential election year to gauge the turnout models because it's just so different, and so things can shift so quickly. But if these small pockets of the Pound Me Too and the Pound Times Out groups actually stay active and motivated and get out there to vote, and we have some other folks that are doing so that maybe didn't participate, things are going to shift fairly wildly. This will be the most interesting off-presidential election I think we've seen in a long time.
Mm-hmm. Zoe. Let's give you a turn finally.
No, absolutely yes to all of that. And Matt, I want to talk to you more about that because, I mean, I think one of the things that a lot of folks are looking at with the Virginia race and New Jersey is going back to 2009 when Scott Brown was elected, right? And Democrats were going, no, that's not some early indicator. That was just this sort of, you know, freak anomaly because of who the candidate was, you know, driving around in his truck and he was a playgirl model, you know, right? It was all.
He was a newscaster, a weatherman of some sort.
He was an underwear model.
Underwear model.
Close to an underwear bomb.
Earlier in his career.
Right, but you've got last week the Wisconsin 10th State Senate going, which went for Trump 17 points last year and then just went for the Democrat by 10 points. So, I mean, you've got to see some kind of through line for that. So, yes, to all of those congressional races. I think one of the things I'm going to be looking at is one of the most undercovered races that we're not talking about is Debbie Stabenow running, and just how Republicans yet again for another cycle seem to just kind of be throwing up a candidate who they're not putting a lot of money into yet. And what I'll be interested to see is if a Democrat or a Republican wins the governorship, hold up, and Debbie wins yet again the U.S. Senate, looking at that margin, because in Michigan we send Democrats now to D.C. Statewide, and yet over the past two election cycles we've kept Republicans here in the state. And so if there's a difference there, and what does that say?
Well, if you look at what the way that the Republican funding class, many of which lives within like, you know, a 30-mile radius of here, is doing, is that they don't have a lot of faith that Debbie Stabenow can be beaten. And that's what whoever the Republican candidate is running up against.
You know, it's an interesting phenomenon that men in I'm a man in his 60s, that what men in their 60s who get a lot of money, there's two time-honored things they're supposed to do. They're supposed to get a 19-year-old mistress, or they're supposed to buy a big expensive boat to throw their money. A boat, you know, is a hole in the water where your money goes. But there's a disturbing tendency. We've got two of them this time, Sandy Pensler and Sri Tanadar, who are decided they're going to spend their millions of dollars on running for hopeless races for office.
So very quickly, is Shree in the audience? Because he registered for tonight. Okay, I'm not seeing him. Now we can talk freely. I just was, he...
I would have talked freely if he was here. It made a lot more fun.
I'm sure you would have. I just wanted it to be fair if he was in the audience.
I have fantasies. I still have fantasies despite my age, and here's my fantasy.
Jack was born as a 60-year-old man, though.
That's true. She knows all my secrets. I want to call Shree up and say, hey, I got an idea. That money, give it to me. And I'll write your name in, and you'll get the same result with no embarrassment.
Or call Rev6 Dad, and we'll shoot you a better commercial.
That's right. And, I could get my students to do that. But you know what? I tried that with Figer 20 years ago, and it didn't work. But let me say before I'm sort of like the Speaker of the House. I'm not supposed to vote. But I'm going to vote on what I'm watching, which is the voters, not politicians' referendum. They've got enough signatures.
They have not been certified yet.
I know. They've almost certainly gotten enough signatures.
They are not certified yet.
They're not certified yet. But, and even if they're certified, will this get on the ballot? Because there will be court challenges. If this gets on the ballot, it will pass. I've seen, we had a similar one in Ohio. It passed with 71%.
Can I ask just really quickly, how many people in this room have signed that ballot? Oh, how many people in this room collected signatures?
How many signed more than once?
I'm sure a few.
So, all right, I'm going to ask one more question, and then I want to turn it over to the audience, who, unlike us, may actually have interesting and fresh ideas. So, I'm going to start with Zoe. Zoe, will the utter mess at Michigan State affect the governor's race or any other race at all?
Until 2 weeks ago, I would have said that's the silliest question I ever heard. And now the last 2 weeks have just sort of been this open conundrum about what MSU is doing. And of course, you have Bill Schuette having his tentacles in it. Gretchen Whitmer was the interim prosecutor of Ingham County at the time. So at this point, it seems like, yeah, I mean, we will absolutely see the name Nassar be part of this governor's race if Schuette and Whitmer are the candidates.
Rick? Both Whitmer and Schuette now have a stake in the outcome of this drama, whatever it is. And, you know, they've been pulled into it. So, yes, it will affect that. And also, you know, we're now going to have both of the incumbents who were up for re-election this year on the Board of Trustees have said they're not going to run again. These education board seats, Wayne State, U of M, and MSU, are typically, for political junkies, measures of baseline political loyalty, because most of the people who vote in those races are people who go all the way to the bottom of the ballot. We could actually see an anomaly that I have not seen in 3 decades of covering politics in Michigan, where there could actually be an issue in a university board race, and it will be where you stand on whether or not Luana Simon should continue as president of the university.
You're assuming she's still there.
Fair enough.
Yes.
Fair enough.
I'm not assuming that she will be, but that would be the issue.
Matt.
As a Spartan, this is a hard topic because, you know, the subject matter in and of itself is as sensitive and bad as it is. But if we're going to look at it from a larger perspective, from a political perspective, there's a constitutional autonomy question that happens, right? State universities get to continue to get their funding from the state of Michigan and can't have the legislature or anybody tell them what to do or what not to do. Okay, so you're entering into a slippery slope when people start saying that Luann Simon has to be fired. And if Tom Izzo and the rest of the board is backing them, does that mean that Hollis has to go? Does that mean that the rest of them have to go? I'm not advocating either way. I'm just saying that this is, to politicize this issue is probably not the wisest thing to do, given the sensitivity of the subject matter, as well as the reality of what the state constitution says in terms of what universities can do with state funding.
I agree with you.
Except it's too late. It's already been politicized.
Yes, it's already been politicized.
I was trying to give you the utopian vision, but that's the reality.
Well, I don't think any of us have ever seen anything quite like this. Well, now I'd like to know what the audience wants to know. And, you know who all of us are. So when you ask a question, please raise your hand. Our intrepid Lindsay will be there. But say your name and what you do, if you wouldn't mind. And who the question is for, or
Phil Reed, we know what you do.
She'll bleep you if you say anything bad.
I'm going to say tectonic shift so you can. Hi, my name is Phil Reed, and my question.
Wait a second. What I'm going to do is repeat the question since the microphone isn't working.
All right. My question is actually for Matt.
Great.
But my name is Phil Reed. I'm a retiree from Chrysler. But my question is...
And? What else do you do?
Oh, I am the treasurer of the Oakland County Democratic Party.
Okay, there we go.
Former chair of the North Oakland Democratic Club.
Oh, there we go again. My stomping grounds.
And an active member of the 8th Congressional District Committee. Anyway, my question is, given the changeover from hard lines to mobile phones, how is that impacting, in your view, not just polling, but voter contact?
It's impacting it greatly in terms of a data company's perspective, and that's why at Rev6 Data Systems, we don't usually advocate for I don't believe in robo-polling. I think that it's nonsense, and I think that it's unscientific, and it's not usable. We advocate for retail politics as much as people don't like it, as much as people are going to say boo-hoo. I don't want somebody showing up on the door. We've found at our firm that when you get somebody on the doorstep that is able to introduce, and we have proper data points behind that can say that I'm here because I know that you're interested in this, that's the best way to connect. And it's a follow-up with a mail piece afterwards. I don't want to bother your cell phones. I don't want to bother your landlines. And unless I can actually talk to you directly and ask you multiple questions live on the phone, I'm not getting any data that's worth a damn, frankly. And anybody that says that that's the case, but there's tons of firms out there that are selling robo-polling and robo-systems, but the landlines are great for a certain age demographic, right? 60-plus, I know that you've still got a landline.
Switch to voice over internet protocols.
Matt?
So I've lost you.
You know what?
Just Skype.
Listening to you talk, and I've realized we've known each other for a few years now, there is a question that I've never asked you, and this is apropos of nothing, and really I should have raised my hand and waited for Lindsay to come over and taken my turn. But
he's married, Zoe.
Right here. What, if there was one thing doing what you do that you wish us political journalists knew?
Good
or
question.
Something that you would like us to think about when we're doing our jobs, what is it that we don't know that you would tell us?
Just keep doing what you're doing.
Oh, bullshit.
No, I'm not kidding. I'm not kidding you.
He's getting free beers from Michigan Radio.
No.
Wants to be invited to another
issue. I think there's been such an assault on the media. I think there's been such an assault in the last year and a half on free press, on the ability for you guys doing your job. And I think that you've known me all long enough, and we've worked in communication settings where there's an understanding that myself as a communications person have an obligation to establish a relationship with you guys in the press corps and to say to you, listen, these are the things that I can tell you on the record, and these are the things I'm going to explain to you off the record. I'm going to respect that you have a job to do, and you're going to respect that I have a job to do. That has been lost in this last year. And I think that you, as journalists, are in a very, and I'm not BSing, you guys have kind of had a really shitty year in terms of the coverage and the assault that's happened. And I think that really you just need to keep reporting the truth and keep pressing, because there are no more professional staff people. There aren't any more people that talk the truth and say, I want to tell you this. You can't report it right now, but I want you to understand this is the background. Do me a favor. Hold it. I'm going to give you a quote, and we'll double back. That relationship has been lost in term limits and under this current administration.
I mean, thank you for that, but being yelled at is part of the job.
Let me comment on that, because I are a journalism professor.
Please.
And I think that I'm very gratified by what Matt said. That's very true. But what worries me, it's bad for, you know, we're used to getting yelled at, as Rick said. The people who it really affects negatively are all of you. And all of my students and people who are unable to differentiate what news is and what news isn't, and you know the difference between all us journalists think you ought to know the difference between the New York Times and Breitbart, but people don't necessarily.
That's what concerns me. The people don't.
That's exactly right. And in the old days, facts were facts. And if you look at Watergate, Nixon never challenged the facts. He lied about what he did, and when he was exposed, he quit and slunk off. And it could mean Democrats that happened to also. But now, if you don't have an acceptance of what is fact and what is fiction, I think this is more frightening for this country than anything I can think of.
Well, two things, though. I think that people do know the difference between the New York Times and Breitbart. And
one of them cost $6 on Sunday.
That's one of the differences. And they're choosing their loyalties and they're choosing their values. But we are in a point now. This is going back probably, I think you were still working for the legislature then. When was the bridge debate?
And oh my gosh, that was Bishop's 2011 and 12. Yeah, 10, yeah. 11.
And
started. It went for two
and
more years.
To Rick Snyder, and the people who really know this story will be showing their age. But an aide to Rick Snyder came to me and said, the problem is in Metro Detroit, it used to be that when J.P. McCarthy, Bob Giles, the publisher of the Detroit News, and Joe Stroud, the editorial page of the Detroit Free Press,
you are agreed,
agreed that a fact was a fact, it was a fact. These were all people who came at things from different perspectives, but they could come to an agreement on where reality met reality. Now, we argue in all of these venues about the nature of facts, and that happens as, Matt, you probably know better than any of us about what a fact is on the floor of the legislature, on the floor of the House, the Senate, within Congress, you know, certainly in political campaigns, but that's always been the case.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's just more true now than ever. Do you remember Yes, Virginia, There Is a Santa Claus, and what her father said? If you read it in the Sun, then it's got to be true.
Yeah.
That's no longer the case.
Let's take another question.
Please.
Somebody.
You know, don't be shy. Raise your hands.
Don't make her run. She's running.
Thank you. Hi. My name is Sue Harden.
Hi, Sue.
Hi. I'm a technology education consultant. And my question is about the U.S. Census coming up in 2020. It's not a very sexy thing. People aren't talking a lot about it, but I have a feeling that it will have a large impact. So my question is twofold. What should we be looking for first? And then second, what can we do to affect a good census with lots of robust data collection?
First of all, whether or not the census actually gets adequately funded. I mean, that's just a huge part of it, that there are real questions about whether or not the government is going to be ramped up and ready to conduct a proper census.
And, of course, we'll be watching to see if, as expected, Michigan loses yet another member of Congress. We've lost 5 members since the 1980s, and most predictions are we'll lose a 6th member. Think of that. We've already lost the voting clout of the entire state of Connecticut.
It's actually quite interesting to think about, too, what that means. I remember, Jack, working with you in 2010 and 2011 and talking about and listening to you talk about what it meant when, you know, we had John Dingell and John Conyers and folks with years and decades of experience and what it looks like now. So the idea that not only would we lose another member of our congressional right. delegation, but the decades and decades of experience.
Well, we've lost something like 350 years of congressional experience.
I did the
like
math,
that.
And just in the past, I think, 4 years, it's like 192 years or something
wow.
like that.
Well, I think that Matt's probably in the best position to talk about what the on-the-ground impact of policymaking in Michigan is.
Yeah, and this is not a commentary on drawing and gerrymandering and all the questions that are out there, but having been a part of the Senate when we drew the maps for the last census and having been at the table, and I'm a map guy, right? I love maps. That's how I figure things out.
I've been in his office. He loves maps.
you know, one thing from just a pure reality standpoint, functionally on the ground, that everybody has to understand is it's much easier to draw a Senate district, okay, than it is to draw a House district from a state level. And it is the same applicable from a U.S., you know, House seat to a U.S. Senate seat.
You don't have to draw any U.S. Senate seats.
Well, my point being is that if you lose a congressman, there's a little bit of a bright spot because it opens up a whole bunch of different areas to move people. And understand something. When we were drawing Senate maps and House seats, there were people that were living in the Detroit River. Okay, the software that they were provided for these offices and these staffers to work with the congresspeople to do this, you would literally look at the map and there would be people living in the Detroit River. Now,
those are Asian carp, man.
Well, they had names that were like
how many
Jones
live in the
and
Detroit
Johnson.
River?
And given a district, maybe 1,000, 500. Right. But when you're drawing maps that have to be precise to a certain number of people per elected official, it gets difficult. So the gerrymandering, understood. But drawing physical maps, and when you change and lose seats, one seat to Congress opens up a whole other population base to shift the whole map, is my point.
Was politics part of drawing those maps?
Not in the Senate. Not in the Michigan Senate, it wasn't, at least under my watch.
I beg to disagree. We have a...
Show me a gerrymandered seat, Jack.
I think I could show you 38 of them.
In the Michigan Senate. I'll give you the House. I'll give you the House.
Well, I'll just give you this, that approximately the same number of people in the last election, the last two elections, have voted for Democratic Senate candidates as opposed to Republican Senate candidates, and this has yielded 27 Republicans and 11 Democrats.
I'm going to ask you a quick question. What's the what would Schwartz call the what's this community disparity?
Communities of interest.
Communities of interest. Yeah. So in certain cases, you're right on communities of interest.
Right.
Okay. Battle Creek has nothing to do with Grand Rapids in
but
terms
a
of
lot
communities
to do
of
with
interest.
Kalamazoo.
It does, but does the population match the community of interest threat?
Well,
level?
You're talking about the congressional district that Tim Walberg got.
Yes, exactly.
But but what you're speaking to is the fact that the Voting Rights Act, ideally that a district, whether it is from the state house, the state senate, Congress, should be compact, contiguous, does not divide governmental lines, divides governmental lines as little as possible. But the Voting Rights Act also says that you have to keep together communities of interest. And Republicans have used that argument to, mostly in congressional districts, to follow the outward migration of Detroit and use that to design congressional districts that reflect that migration over decades. But that does create a problem, a political problem, for Democrats.
And look at Senator Knopf's district. What does Battle Creek have to do with
in West
Barry?
Michigan.
Yeah, in West Michigan.
I think we're getting deeply into the weeds here. Yeah. And let's take another question from somebody.
And while Lindsay is going to that question, if someone can actually define to me in 2018 what a community of interest looks like, I would love to know what that definition is.
Right on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Somebody.
Hi there. I'm a. My name is Alice Horning. I'm a retired Oakland University faculty member, and I'm a huge fan of Michigan Radio. Thank you for the work you do.
Thank you.
Thank you for the kind words.
Bringing us the real news. My question is your response to Fire and Fury, the new book. Thanks.
Who's read it?
Phil Reed can give you a response to Fire and Fury.
Have you read it?
I've read
can I borrow it?
Well, it certainly has created a sensation, hasn't it?
Well, I think there's an interesting question in that is for the journalists on the panel here. At what point when you're questioned, Ms. Michael Wolff, did he embellish? How does that work when you use?
What was the line that, and I can't, you'll remember, was it David Remnick of The New Yorker who said, Michael Wolff is the journalist that the president, Donald Trump, deserves? Was that right? Was it? And was it Remnick?
And I think that's probably accurate. You should, like, as a president, working in these positions as a press person, to let somebody in that you don't know what their intent is or whether or not you've established a clear understanding of what is it you're trying to get. To if I let Pluta into the White House to sit on the couch all day, having known him for all these years, I'd be like, what is this guy? What are you doing? Like, well, you're here again? How do you have that blue pass around your neck? Because the White House isn't the easiest place to get into.
I'd be drinking a beer.
Can I?
I would hope so.
So I just came from Michigan radio about 2.5 hours ago, and I want to give sort of an example of what I think, not knowing Michael Wolff, not reading the book. Let me give an example. So today, and I'm going to go back to the Nassar coverage, today one of the testimonies, one of the young women who was so powerfully able to say her story, said that MSU was still billing her family for the Nassar visits that she had. The Guardian, the Detroit Free Press, the headline is MSU still billing. So Kate Wells, who is our reporter at Michigan Radio, who has been there every single day, which you can just imagine is a whole nother story to sit in that courtroom every single day, called me and our news director and said, you know, do we go to air with this? Well, it was the testimony, and it sure sounds like something right after everything that we've heard that MSU would do. And our news director said, well, do we have the proof? Do you have a bill? Now, this has nothing to do with all of the devastation that this young woman has had to deal with, but it's a part of the story. Do you have the bill to show us? And the lawyer said, we don't right now. So we decided as a news organization that we weren't going to air to say that, that it was not what we were going to do. It's right. Not about kudos, but it's that a lot of other news organizations, and I would argue probably someone like a Wolf, would be the first to tweet that. And so it's taking the moment to figure out, do you have a source? Have you seen it? Because we're not super interested in how many clicks we can get. We're pretty interested in the facts. And so for me, it's a really clean and clear example of what I think when I say that Michael Wolf is the journalist that Donald Trump deserves. That maybe some of it was true, maybe it isn't. Maybe MSU is still billing, but we don't know. And we're not going to go to print, and we're not, certainly you're not hearing it on our airwaves this evening.
And I thank you for that.
Well, I think
I would go in a slightly different direction, though, in answering that question. I don't know Michael Wolff. I'm aware of his reputation. And he went in, though, with, and there are some journalists who are like, you know, his methods are very questionable. Other journalists who went, you know what, he went in and his goal was to burn his sources and tell it like it was, and God bless him for it. And that's not, and it's a particular commentary that I'm remembering, and said that, well, you know, the New York Times and the Washington Post would do well to learn from this. And the problem is that most journalists who cover an administration, any administration, have to come to understandings that they have to do it on a daily basis, that they don't get to sit on the couch and hope that people will talk to them, make promises that may or may not be kept in the course of how the reporting gets done, and then at the end of it, just, slap the dust off their hands, walk away, and move on to the next project. It's a daily slog. And that's the part that I think that journalists struggle with. Do we make deals? Yes, we do. We come to understandings.
We have agreements.
Not deals on whether or not this is a fact or that is not a fact. As a matter of fact, and
on the record or off the record.
But Matt and I have argued, I would say, fiercely at times.
For sure.
Over whether or not something is fair game. But you don't make a deal on whether or not something is accurate or not. That you don't make a deal to meet in the middle on a fact. But you do have to work with these people every day.
And the problem is that this White House is employing a bunch of children who don't understand how the rules work. If I say to you, hey, you want to ask me a question, and I say, you want to go on background, or do you want to go off the record? You know that we're having two separate conversations, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't think anybody there has any idea.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not there. I can't say. But I also...
I can tell by the bad press coverage they got a problem.
On that, though, that first of all, there are not common understandings about the terms of our craft. What is background? What is deep background? What is off the record? That was not always the case. I don't have a conversation without a source, at least the first time, without saying, what is our common understanding of what that is?
But isn't this date night bromance that you two are having right now part of why folks who don't trust the media...
Well, that's right. It's inside baseball.
Right,
inside
are baseball. Able to say, well, we don't trust the media, Rick Pluta, because we know deep down you have a deal with Matt Marsden. And it might be the most vanilla, perfect deal in all the land. And I to this
Well, then let's explain that.
In what?
Exactly how that
Where?
Works.
In the conventional wisdom, off the record means you can't use this at
Thank
all.
Thank you, sir.
Deep background means you can sort of use the facts without any kind of attribution. Background, you used to see all the time when Gerald Ford was president, it would say, a source close to the Secretary of State. It was always the Secretary of State.
It was the Secretary of State.
That'd be me.
That was the unimpeachable source.
That's right.
And on the senior level.
And on the record. If you look today, by the way, I do commentary, which is sort of opinion, but...
He opines.
It's not just, well, I was scratching my behind today and I thought this. It has to be based on facts. And I try not to use many unattributed sources. And today's commentary was about the legality of Michigan State asking the Attorney General's office for an opinion about the Luana Simon matter. And I happened, a very high judicial person called me about this. And because they're not supposed to do it by name, they told me, they gave me some very interesting information. So I indicated this person knew what they were talking about without, I suppose that's deep background.
Jack, you're not helping me out on this. Let's be honest with everyone. You just used when I threw them under the bus.
Isn't it about relationships? But, like, if you trust...
Yes.
Like, I trust you, Jack, if I called you and said, if I tell Jack I want to tell him something because I think it's important.
Right.
You'll honor that as a journalist.
But when Rick and Jack are thrown in the same pool as a Breitbart reporter, which is what is happening today, it's changed the dichotomy of when Jack or Rick say an off-the-record source versus a reporter like Michael Wolff who says it.
I don't know how to fix that.
How do we fix that? I don't know.
Part of it is
I think we get thrown into the same pool.
Right. Part of it is the nature of understanding of terms, and in fact, Governor Milliken, Senate Governor Milliken, told me once that he said classy guy. He said that Charlie Kane, the late Charlie Kane of the Detroit News, this guy is a son of a bitch. Then he said that's off the record.
I miss Charlie Kane.
And Charlie McCain printed that, and Milliken said, I told you it was off the record, and Charlie said, yes, Governor, you said it after you said it. And so Milliken went to his press secretary, and the press secretary said, that's exactly right. It's your fault, Governor, but I'm not sure. But let me full circle, to go back to my distinguished colleague, who's faculty colleague, who's smarter than I am because she can sit at the bar and doesn't have to grade papers tonight. let me say that the thing about the Michael Wolff book is, if you look at the totality of it, as one of my colleagues said, if you look at how it came to be written, the access these people had, and what these people were saying, I think that is the more important thing, the atmosphere it describes, than any particular quote or any particular anecdote, which may or may not be right. Again, this is an administration like none anyone has ever seen before. Next question.
My name is Marianne Fontana.
Hi, Marianne.
Hi. I'm retired.
From what?
I was a small business owner. Okay, so basically, now that you've been talking about the, the Wolf book, and I just finished reading Donna Brazile's Hacks, and I'm a lifelong Democrat, and I'm very concerned about the Democratic Party, even though I feel that, and I hope that the Republican Party is totally self-imploded by this point, but I was just wondering what your opinions were regarding, you know, a lot of the things that she expressed in that book. And the way, I mean, frankly, I feel I was pretty sympathetic towards her, I would have to say, just reading that book and the dilemmas that she faced between the hacking issues and, you know, just being thrown into that position and trying to, you know, do the right thing, so to speak. Although she's, you know, a tough cookie, so I'm sure there's a lot of people that have maybe not such a, you know, might have different opinions about her. But I'm just curious about what you would say.
Who wants to tackle
regards
that?
To that?
Politics is a tough business. And, you know, listen, the Republican Party has its issues and the Democratic Party has their issues. And sometimes when you're a staffer and a consultant and you've served for a long time, you are kind of given a raw deal. And, you know, when you get that deal and you have the ability to say, listen, this is my reality. This is what I think. This is what I've seen. I feel that she has every right and should have said what she said, because she was clearly aggrieved and felt that her counsel wasn't taken to heart. And frankly, in the case of Michigan, it wasn't taken to heart. 0.002% loss in Michigan for Hillary. Somebody on the Democratic Party side, no offense, was not conveying to that campaign, you need to be here, 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 and here, and you need to support this, that, and the other.
Well, my sense of it was, though, that the campaign, the message was delivered, the message was not received.
And that's the campaign manager's fault. They were practicing
a particular type of party discipline where they thought that they had built on the Obama data-driven campaign, and in fact, they had kind of screwed up the Obama data-driven campaign.
I mean, even John Kerry was still paying to turn out voters in the city of Detroit as a rich guy from Boston. When they said, you need to get people to the doors, he paid it.
So I'll just give this little secret, and this is only because this was top of mind earlier today. I was talking to someone who asked how I started at Michigan Radio, and I desperately wanted to work in politics. I mean, literally, like 8 hours ago, I was telling this story. I wanted to desperately work in politics.
Thank God you didn't.
Times 1,000. And I was, you know, I was like the West Wing generation, right? That politics is going to make change. And I was a senior at U of M, and there was an internship for the political analyst, Jack Lessenberry.
Poor kid.
And I was like, I'm going to get this internship, and I'm going to do it for the summer so I can understand how bad the media is. And so then when I work for politics, I can understand how to, like, get them to say the right thing and get them to be good, you know. And I started interning for Jack, and within 2 weeks, it was like whiplash. It was like, ooh, politics isn't perfect, and neither side is good. And Jack would tell me stories of things at that point. It was covering it for 30 years.
Right.
Of
now it's 92.
Of now
you were just a young lady
92.
When you came to the Senate when I was there when I first met you.
I was 8 years old. And and what I realized really quickly is whether you're a Republican or whether you're a Democrat, you want to read Fire and Fury, and you want to believe every single line because it helps inform what you believe, and you read Donna Brazile's book, and you want to believe every single thing, or you listen to Steve Bannon, and you believe it all. And the fact is, these are all just human characters who are doing a job, and they're trying to do their job well. And it's not black or white. Democrats aren't always right. Republicans aren't always right. There's a gray area. And so when you ask, you know, the question of, well, what did you make of this book? I think, well, there's a person who had a job, and she wrote a book of what that job was like. And if any of us wrote a book about what our jobs were like, and then we found a coworker who worked with us, I mean, wouldn't they go, no, that's not how it was at all?
I want to take issue.
And Donna Brazile had a tough year.
And the lost art is the guys that don't ever tell.
Right. No, the Matt Marsden, that's the book I want to read. This dude has more secrets than all of us combined about Michigan politics, and he's just nope.
They used to say those who talk don't know and those who know don't talk. But I want to take issue with something you said about the Republican Party imploding. And I can understand from your standpoint the temptation of that. What we need in this country is two healthy, sane parties. When Sandy Levin ran against Bill Milliken for governor, you knew that whoever won would you'd have a decent administration. When Jimmy Carter ran against Gerald Ford, the first campaign I was around for as a reporter, although I was always a political junkie, nobody thought the world would be destroyed if their candidate didn't win. So we need to have a, this is what we need to get back to. We need to get civility and decency, and people who sort of agree on 2 + 2 = 4. The problem is not now that some people will think, thank you.
The other thing, too, is that after Obama won, there was this thought that the Republican Party was done. It was going to implode. That you remember when people were talking about
that?
And they came up with a report that said Marco Rubio has to run in 2012 or the Republican Party is going to implode.
Yeah, and or evaporate.
Right.
And the same thing, has happened after the last couple of election cycles with, with Democrats. We are a country that appears to have a two-party system, and that when there are third parties or other movements that become involved, that somehow the two parties, either one of them or the other or both of them, will incorporate whatever that movement is into them. And so we're kind of always going to be a two-party system, and it seems to sort into a system that is somewhat leftish and somewhat rightish. And the history of our country, by and large, is not the history of the 70s and the 80s, where the most liberal Republican was more liberal than the most conservative Democrat. It's more like it is today, where the most liberal Republican is still more conservative than the most conservative.
It's about the middle, man, the independents. Come on. There's a ton of people that don't want to party affiliate.
Yeah, they don't want to party affiliate, but they still behave like they, when they go into the voting booth, they still behave like they are partisans.
Let me make one other little observation before I forget it, is that we have been talking tonight as if 2018 was destined to be a wave Democratic election. May well be, but I remember in 1982 was a wave election for the Democrats. They gained 26 seats in the House. They gained in the U.S. Senate, and it was common. And prognosticators said after that election that Reagan was sure to be a one-term president. So we just don't know. Next question.
Hi, my name is Nick. I live in Clinton Township. Hi. As a history teacher, I understand that this question is fraught with peril, but I hope you'll try it. As we near the end of the Snyder term, what do you think his legacy will be?
I just went to all of them and said, let Jack answer this one.
I'm afraid his legacy is going to be Flint. Now, and the legacy of what happens when you don't sort of adequately mine the store. Now, when the new bridge is up and built, the Gordie Howe International Bridge, it should be said that that bridge would not have happened had it not been for Rick Snyder. But right now, I think that's the legacy. But I'd like to know what Matt thinks.
I think that he will be the first businessman, governor, self-funder that served two terms in office. I think that he will have taken the state from a not great place economically and righted it. I think that there's a slew of things I won't say because I just think that he sort of embodies what's not right with a businessman that is the governor. And I think you're seeing that with the president. When you have people that can self-fund and that are businessmen, they get into office. And I was there when he first took office in the Senate Majority Leader, and he did not understand that the legislature doesn't work for him. He put a clock down on Randy Richardville's table. It had a dog's tail that waved.
That's breaking news, folks. And that's a story we didn't know.
And he said, okay, this is how many days you have to balance the budget. And you know what that did to Randy and the rest of the senators?
Made them not want to do it.
No. When he left the office, he shoved the clock off the desk. So we don't work in dog years. So, my point being is when you have somebody that comes in like that is not familiar with the culture that is politics, and it is a culture, and you can hate it as much as you want and be mad at it as much as you want, but the reality is that this is an institution. It's a democracy. And it works the way it works, and you're never going to change it. Even with term limits, you're never going to change the culture that is Lansing.
Well, except,
I would just quickly like to make one more request that we bring Matt another beer, because these are the best stories that I've heard in a really long... Oh, I know. I saw there's a full one. I'm saying let's make sure there's one more.
Yeah, the dog-biting story is a new one. But the thing is...
Well, you brought me here to please, right?
I love you.
Except that one of the things that Rick Snyder did that no governor had done since... We had done this since the new budget was harmonized the state's budget cycle with the budget cycles of local governments, school districts, and universities, which was a really big deal if you're doing that. Do voters care? No.
No.
But... This really, really, really mattered, and it had never been done before because it was so damn hard.
Because we also shut down the government in 13.
During a recession. Now, governors in Michigan governors, because of the nature of our boom and bust economy, skate and sink based on what's happening with the national economy. And Rick Snyder benefited from what was happening with the national economy. He didn't fix Michigan's economy. He may have made it better than it might have been otherwise, but he didn't fix it.
He got them to agree on a budget deadline.
But we weren't pushing which had never, ever happened before, and that's my point. That's a big deal. The fixing the economy, he didn't do that. But he did do stuff that matters. One, Rick Snyder's legacy is going to be bookended.
The dog's tail.
Your point?
That's what it did. You know, it did have an impact.
It did. Rick Snyder's legacy is going to be bookended by the Detroit rescue and how that worked and the Flint water crisis and how emergency management in that city failed.
And getting Mayor Duggan into Detroit as mayor.
Yeah, it's amazing to get a budget on time when you have Republicans in the House and Republicans in the supermajority in the Senate and you have a Republican governor.
3 months early because the state's budget cycle was off sync with everyone else's.
How many nights did we stay there till 1 a.m. before him?
Mm-hmm. In September.
Yeah. It was dysfunctional. I don't know if you actually know this story. I'm not even sure. But now that Matt started with telling stories that maybe we shouldn't tell, I remember
I don't work for him anymore.
I remember the night of the budget shutdown getting calls from the governor's, this was Granholm's administration, complaining about a Jack essay. This was the night that the government was going to shut down. And in the governor's office, they were calling us about an essay that you wrote on Michigan radio.
Well, it must have been especially perceptive. And next question.
My name is Alex Markle. I'm an attorney downtown in Detroit. Talking about Snyder's...
What kind of law?
Large-scale commercial litigation.
Okay. We just want to know this before we answer.
That's right.
As we look at the end of Snyder's administration, how do you see it impacting the 2018 gubernatorial election in Michigan?
Every election, at least at the outset of the campaign, starts out as a referendum on the last one, which is why... Every Republican in the race knows that they're starting with a millstone around their neck. Am I wrong?
No.
Okay. So the question is, can they drop that millstone and come up with something that's new and refreshing? What Republicans don't have the luxury of doing this time around, like George H.W. Bush did when he was following Ronald Reagan, was, hey, let's do more of the same. Brian Kelly is basing his campaign on that, but he's got to persuade voters that the Snyder administration has been a success in Michigan the way that the Reagan administration was perceived as a success at the end of that administration.
Jack, how many lieutenant governors have gone on to become governor?
One. I mean, I think it was about 1830. It was a long time ago. But added to that, just take out the whatever the weaknesses of the Snyder administration are, we normally like to switch parties after 8 years. Mm-hmm. Since 1998, we've done that. And so that's something people, Michiganders are ticket splitters. We go back and forth. We're independents. And so that is a very real factor also.
One of the most fascinating listener emails or like the Facebook responses that I see on Michigan radio is when we do a story about Snyder, and it's obviously a story that folks don't like, and then they'll say, yeah, and his puppy dog, Shooty, is going to just have the same Snyder administration, you know. And I want to go, oh, there is so much more behind
that.
But
if you watch this, Shooty is not running at this point against Gretchen Whitmer. He's running against Snyder. Mm-hmm. Snooty, because if Shooty knows, he's a very shrewd person, he knows if he's identified with Snyder, he's toast. And so he has, this is why he's prosecuting people in Flint, including some people who even some Republicans think shouldn't be prosecuted. So this is a very interesting and complex dynamic.
He's running against Rick Snyder. He's running against Brian Kelly.
Right.
He's running against Gretchen Whitmer, and he's running against Jennifer Granholm.
And I think Gretchen
and Hillary Clinton.
And I think Gretchen Whitmer has an has to really take a look at how disciplined she's going to be, because not too long ago, a week or two ago, there was a big push by many to say, is Gary Peters willing to do it? Is Kildee willing to do it? Is somebody else willing to get in? She's not listening or paying attention to certain parts of the state that the Democratic establishment wants. So it's incumbent upon her. That's the uniqueness between the Democrats and the Republicans. The Democrats clear the field for their pick. And Gretchen, now we've got to watch these three fight it out. Don't forget about Patrick Kolbeck. That's 3% of the vote, man. I mean,
well, that's Brian Kelly's savior.
Well, quite possibly,
nomination.
Coming from a guy that won a six-way primary.
But the Democratic
Congress,
nomination is not decided.
What's that?
The Democratic nomination is not decided.
Well, I think it is decided. I think it is by people, by Peter saying no, thank you, by Kildee saying no, thank you, and unless Duggan decides to get in, I don't know who else is going to challenge Gretchen.
We're seeing a series of forums that Democrats are convening around the state because the party leaders know that based on what's happened in the public recently tells them that they need to settle on someone and very quickly. And Democrats in Michigan do something that's rather unique, which is even though the primary is in August, in April, they will hold what's called an endorsement convention. And the idea is to let all of the lower ballot candidates, the ones that are nominated at conventions, to go and get a sense of where the party stands on them and get an idea on who the likely nominees are.
It's much more friendly than any Republican convention.
They basically say, these are our nominees unless they're indicted between now and August.
If it works.
So they can raise money.
But Matt,
so they can raise money, so they can set up an organization. But the thing is, the big question hanging over all of that is still unanswered in August, and that is, who is the gubernatorial nominee
right.
going to be?
And Matt, everything you said about Gretchen Whitmer being, you know, the anointed yes, 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 and that's what I was saying on March 6th of 2016 about one Hillary Clinton, and then Michigan went for Bernie Sanders, and it was like this whiplash of all of us going, wait, let's put this in perspective, and we had the whiplash for about 24 hours, and then it was, no, but Michigan's still going to go Democratic. So I get exactly what you're saying, but I think there has to be some asterisk, which is, yes, it's Gretchen Whitmer's, just like it was Hillary Clinton's on March 7th
and then
at
12:01. And then that links to Jennifer Granholm.
Yeah. That.
There's one thing that I can tell you out of my years of experience I'm certain of, and that is that there'll be some weird-ass thing, issue, that happens between now and the election that may be significant, it may be silly, but there'll be some weird-ass thing we cannot anticipate that will affect this election.
A giant meteor.
What that is, I do not know. But I do know that 20 years ago, we could have all become very rich by going to Las Vegas and betting that a black guy with an African name would be the next president. And 4 years ago, 3 years ago, maybe even 2 years ago, we could have done the same thing on betting on Donald Trump. So what we know is we don't know. Next question.
Next question.
Oh, yeah, hi. My name is Brian. I am a retired technical writer.
Hi, Brian.
Why is everybody retired except us?
Yeah. Well,
no doubt, man.
Maybe
is technical writing
there.
That lucrative?
Apparently they bought
maybe
stock
maybe it's
20
time.
Years ago.
Anyway, my question is, for anybody up there, what do you see Donald Trump's influence on the midterm vote here in Michigan?
Good question. Let's start with Matt, the Republican.
Whoa. I'm agnostic. I work in data. I may have certain.
That makes you the best person.
I think that it's going to be painful. I think if what you look at Lansing yesterday, there were a lot of men and women that marched on the Capitol saying we're not about that. And I think if you don't take that into account, it's going to be problematic. And I honestly just, as a general voter, just person, I hope all of you folks that support that movement can prove wrong those people that say that you can't sustain it. Keep it going. Keep up your efforts, because you will be the ones in an off-presidential election year that change the tide. And you have to stay committed to it, because this is not from, as a data man, I know the numbers. I know where things drop off. I know where they accelerate. And you have to get new people involved, and you have to bring your coalition, and you have to go get your absentee ballots, and you have to fill them out and do things the way that it hasn't been done before. It will be a big deal. That will be the game changer.
There's another metric, though, which is, you know, if you're going to just look at that one, is even though there were 4,000 people, according to the state police estimates, at the Capitol this year, there were 6,000 last year.
So take 2,000 off, then add the equal amount in Chicago, the equal amount in LA, the equal amount in Denver, right? I mean, if we're talking just state, sure, 2,000 drop-off point for me is nothing. I can find 2,000 voters to replace that just couldn't get there for the day. Mm-hmm. And I'll call them up and say, hey, listen, maybe, you could make the march.
Yeah. As you know, the public opinion survey research is about trends, not just absolutes. That
depending on the techniques that they use, the survey.
Depending on the techniques and what's happening. But the fact that there were fewer this year than there were last year.
No, I only love Richard Chuba.
still says something. And I'm not saying, I mean, it's a lot of people. I've covered more rallies at the state capitol than I can count, and 4,000 is an amazing number.
Oh, because I thought you were saying it was not an amazing number.
No, it is an amazing number.
I think 4,000 people on a Sunday in the rain and cold is a pretty significant number.
Is an amazing number. But
considering one of these people that was there carrying a sign is sitting right over there, who happens to be married to me. Mm-hmm. And
and is a Republican.
Acknowledge it. Yeah. It was a teacher.
I'm just saying don't be complacent. Don't assume that it's going to be this way because of that.
It's on this crowd right here that's listening to do this. That's different. Honest to gosh, you guys, I say this every time I come on the show. Do I not?
You do.
You have to go vote. You have to get your friends to vote. You have to do this. This situation is based on the decisions that everybody here has made or not made. Well, and this movement can continue to stop it, and frankly, it needs to stop. This dude's a lunatic.
I don't say this in an advocacy role, but Zoe and I have said many times on our segment that Republicans don't win statewide elections in Michigan so much as Democrats lose them.
And that's right. And Democrats need to understand something. You need to stop always adhering to what your unions tell you and using the old companies, the firms that you use. You know what? I'll offer Rev6 data up to any Democrat that wants to come by and talk to me and tell me why they want to run. I'll help them pro bono. Because here's the deal. You guys, the one thing about the Democratic Party, and I think you'll agree with me, if I'm wrong, tell me, is that you have a system that's very different than the Republican system is that you have to accept the vendors and the people. Because I'm a Republican as branded, I'm no good because I'm a Republican. But I want good people to win races. I want good people. I don't care about party affiliation. But the parties have to wake up a little bit to this. And so that's my parting comment for the night, party has to.
I'm speaking from a nonpartisan perspective, but I think Matt is right. I think that the Democratic Party has frequently offended the voters of the state of Michigan by nominating candidates for some of these statewide offices who are being put on there to check a box that you have to have one African American, you have to have supported by labor. In 1998, they nominated a candidate for Secretary of State who did not even seem to be compos mentis, because they had to check off that box. Had Democrats nominated the pro-life anti-abortion candidate Scott Bowen for Attorney General in 2006, Mike Cox would have been defeated. But they didn't because they had to check a box. And so I am not against diversity. This is the main focus of what I do at running the journalism department at Wayne State University. But I think that you can't do it in a mindless fashion, and Democrats need to think about that.
Lindsay, I think we see right about 12 o'clock.
Hi, I'm Dave Harden. I'm married to Sue. She asked a question earlier.
Hey, Dave.
I'm retired.
What is wrong with everyone?
Did you buy like Microsoft?
You should try it.
I'm retiring tomorrow.
Wonderful. You should try it.
Can you give me some investment advice after all this is over?
No. In my opinion, democracy is under threat today. Can you give me any reason to be hopeful? Democracy itself.
That I can give you a whole bunch of reasons.
We're all in this room right now just like throwing darts at every single thing and every single person that's in charge and in power, and it's not getting shut down.
That if you look at just our industry, that if you look at donations to public broadcasting, they're up. That one of the things, and I'm an old newspaper
guy. So you're not retiring.
I'm an old newspaper guy. And one of the things that the newspaper industry has been struggling with is how do you make money in the digital age? Well, the New York Times and the Washington Post, thank you, Donald Trump, have now figured out how to do that. And news organizations, chains that are lower on the food scale, are now figuring out how to do exactly the same thing. We have millennials who are now suddenly used to subscribing to things. Netflix, who are like, they don't expect everything to be free, especially if there's a quality, if there's quality to it. We're not out of the woods, but there's certainly some hopeful signs that people care about accuracy and information, that they're willing to plunk down for it, and that they're willing to get active for whatever it is that they believe in.
And sometimes happens.
They want it right.
Sometimes you have to have a bad president. Sometimes you have to have somebody you don't like to wake up to realize that, you know what, this isn't the guy I wanted, and I got to pay more attention and out and vote.
You know what? Every 4 years, 55%.
This is a little bit different.
45% of the public doesn't like whoever is in the White House.
More than
38% like.
More than 400,000 people in this state signed petitions to try to fix the way redistricting is done. I think that's an indication, whatever your politics, that democracy.
And I applaud them, because having run a ballot proposal for your volunteer base, for you to get 450,000 signatures is one of the most impressive things I've seen. I spent a great deal of my company's money to try and collect 270,000 on a ballot proposal in the last election year, and that was probably sufficient, but not sufficient enough, but it was paid for, and you guys did it with a volunteer base, and I applaud you.
That's amazing. That never happens.
And I was very quick to answer your question, and now I'm going to just be as flip and as quick and say the idea that any of us right now are complaining, I just don't have patience for the idea that we're complaining right now that we don't live in a democracy. And look around the world. The idea that we are saying right now that we aren't living in a first world country with a democracy, or that this is the end, I hate to say it, but that to me is special snowflake.
Next question. Lindsay has lost 3 pounds already.
Hi, my name is Jimmy Chin. I'm a retired engineer.
Jeez, oh, Pete.
What?
You're joking. You
seven
are not
in a row.
Stop it, but you have a great sense of humor. You're not retired. You're totally joking.
Not yet. Maybe next year.
That was funny.
First, I'd like to ask, where do you guys stand on a giant meter issue?
What?
The giant meteor issue.
But really,
I thought it was cool. That's
really
where I stand,
funny.
And I heard it boom outside my house.
Here, come take my chair.
Did you find a rock? Because if you did, it's worth a lot, like 30,000.
Most of them are my brain.
Is that the one that crashed over Michigan?
Might have hit my head.
Okay.
So one of the things that I've always thought is that despite all of the activism that's been happening, really they haven't shown a lot of results. And over the last several years, I think the policies that have been enacted in the U.S. has been slowly moving to the right, and I feel like the entire country has been moving to the right for the last, I don't know, well, I guess 25 years. And I wonder if you have a question in there somewhere? I do. Because, you know, I wonder if you agree with that and if you think that's problematic and if it's solvable or fixable, if it is a problem.
Can I do the answer that Jack would do, which is for 8 years we had a president named Barack Hussein Obama? Is that how you would answer
it? She speaks for me. I think obviously that's been doing that with a vengeance since Donald Trump was elected president, and it's gone. It depends on what you mean by going to the right. If you take in terms of social legislation, in terms of policies that have tended to benefit the upper 1% and the upper part of the, that's been happening since 1981. But in terms of, I remind you that I think 10 years ago, 25 years ago, it was inconceivable that we would live to see same-sex marriage legal. And now it's not only legal, it's very broadly accepted. So I think it's on an issue-by-issue basis, but these folks may think something else.
Matt, I'd love to hear your perspective on that, just because you are a Republican that's pushing basically for the legalization of marijuana in the state.
Yeah, sure, I am. Because I believe that, first of all, it's a crop. First of all, it's an agricultural commodity. Second of all, it's a tax revenue stream for the state of Michigan. We are talking about an industry in California that's going to make $7 billion off of something that grows from the earth, okay? And this right here is taxed, right? That wine is taxed. It's controlled. And the thing is that other states, when you look at what these states are generating, when it's properly done, and I believe that we can either take the Jeff Sessions approach, which is like, marijuana is so evil, you know, the Keebler Elf approach, because that's what it is. It's 1960s, Nixon era.
Watch for Matt on Saturday Night Live.
The reality is that this is something that can, A, either medicinal or recreational, do a great deal. And when these municipalities, especially local municipalities, have arrangements where they say, okay, if you want to come in and grow and control and do it like the lottery, do it like cigarettes, do it like booze, every sin in this state is controlled and taxed. And right now, it's not taxed at all. So control it and regulate it and make it for adult use. And you're going to generate a huge revenue stream that's going to go to public education. And the one thing I disagree with on the recreational ballot is they try to apply it to transportation, which we just had a tax increase to fix. It should go to public health opiate addiction. It should go to crayons in the classroom and teachers and education. And it should go to law enforcement, because law enforcement still does not have a line item state budget that funds it in the state of Michigan.
Well, the bottom
but
line
getting to your question, though, is that America is moving to the right. America and Michigan is moving to the right and to the left. That the voters are sorting out in both of those. And even though, you know, there are people who do public opinion research who are saying that more and more people are identifying as independents, but the problem with that analysis is they're identifying as independents because they don't want to identify as a Republican or a Democrat, but they still behave like a Republican right. or a Democrat when they go into the voting booths more and more and more, and that disparity is very stark. Exactly.
Yeah. My mother-in-law's boyfriend claims to be an independent, even though the last Democrat he voted for was Harry Truman.
But he would tell you he's an independent.
And most of the independents are conservatives.
And doesn't the fact that Jack Lessenberry has a mother-in-law's boyfriend make you want to do yoga and take whatever supplements you're taking on a daily basis?
I would think that looking at me would make them want to do yoga and take... And let me... Just one thing. Prohibition doesn't work. We
Thank
ought
you.
To have learned that
I loved
in
your
the
piece,
1920s.
By the way.
Okay, we've got like 7 minutes left, so should we do a lightning round? Did you see I just totally started producing this from you? I totally just took the mic.
Thank you, because we seem like we've covered a lot of ground.
And here's how we're
going
to do it.
Go for it, baby. There's a late, very demure young lady here who's had her hand up forever. And I go. But, oh, oops.
Oh, is this mic?
I'm sorry. Go.
Like an ice cream cone.
Oh,
talk
okay.
right into it.
Okay, I'm sorry. I was watching you look that way. I didn't know if it was my turn. I just want to say how much I appreciate being part of this forum tonight. My name is Linda. I'm not retired. I will never retire. I will always be engaged.
What do you do?
You're with me.
Hi, Linda. And I'm a former teacher. I'm currently a mediator with Oakland Mediation Center. I'm a community worker, and I formed an indivisible group after the elections. I've been campaigning with the voters, not politicians, and supporting education on issues so that we don't become divided by parties. And I happened to meet this most amazing young man named Dr. Abdul El-Sayed, who's running for governor. Yeah.
From Detroit?
I happened to meet Gretchen Whitmer, and I haven't heard anybody speak about Dr. Abdul. Mm-hmm. And as someone who's an educator, this man is quite brilliant.
May I take a risk and impale myself?
Thank you.
Can I say one more thing
sure.
before? I think his approach, and this is trying to be unbiased in terms of not being a Democrat or a Republican, but looking at someone who has the mind and ability to analyze issues and look at what brings us together rather than what divides us. And I'm looking for someone who knows how to bring people together and look at root issues, root causes to problems, and what is it that we all want when it comes to educating our children, when it comes to clean environment, when it comes to health care for everyone. There are several very important issues that I think that will bring us together, and someone that knows how to do that. So I want your commentary.
Let me start, and then I'll turn to everybody else. Abdul El-Sayed is unquestionably brilliant. I have no doubt that he has a higher IQ than any of the other candidates. He is unquestionably charismatic, but he has some major drawbacks. Number one, he is 32 years old and has almost no experience. Now, we elected two governors, the last two governors, had no experience with the legislature, one Republican, one Democrat, and we suffered for that. Number two, and this is a very controversial thing to say, but it's very true, he is unelectable, and I will tell you why.
He's right.
It's because we are racist, and I'm going to prove to you right now that he could never get elected. The most popular Arab American in this state is a man named Ismail Ahmed, who is a friend of mine. He's very accomplished. He founded the best private welfare group in the nation. He is the deputy provost or the assistant provost of the University of Michigan, Dearborn. He was nominated in 2016 by the Democrats, this revered man, for a position on the State Board of Education. The State Board of Education has slightly less power than the Clausen PTA. The only thing they can do, they can hire a superintendent, and they can make suggestions. They can make suggestions to schools that they don't have to follow. 225,000 Democrats refused to vote for him because he was an Arab American. Now, do you think these folks are going to vote for somebody like that for governor? Now, I would love to see Abdul El-Sayed get in the politics. I would love to see him in the legislature. I think if Gretchen Whitmer or whoever wins, they would be very well advised to make him Secretary of Health and Human Services. But I don't think he's ready to be governor, and I don't think he's electable, and these folks can tell me if I'm wrong.
Well, I'll jump in, and I'm not going to say whether or not he's electable. He's working very, very, very hard, and certainly we have seen he's being portrayed in national media as potentially the Barack Obama of Michigan. And there was a point at which, you know, people said someone named Barack Hussein Obama could never be elected sure. president of the United States. Fair point. But the case that you just made for Abdul El-Sayed is also the case that Rick Snyder made for his own candidacy.
But, and I, what I would argue, and I've met Abdul and had long conversations, and absolutely I agree that it's this inspiring nature. I think for me what it is it's not so much the name or the person, it's the idea of inspiration and the idea that a candidate could fill in all these blanks and all these holes of who we all inspire to be, you know, the better people, you know, country before all of us. And I think that's really what he's hooked into, whether or not it's that he's 32 or 52 or that he, you know, ran a department in Detroit or not. I think what he's keyed into is the idea that we all want to be our best selves. And I think that's what Barack Obama ran in 08 and in 12. And it's that narrative.
Which is why he's getting that sort of attention.
Absolutely.
Right. I think that's a good sign that people think that. Sure. Matt, what do you think?
You better hire the best people there are, because winning elections is hard. And especially right. a 32-year-old man trying to run for governor against the establishment that he's running against, you better hire the smartest, quickest, cheapest paid cats you can get. Because you know what? The reality is winning elections, and this is no judgment on him. This is just a function of the business that politics is. If you don't have a great team in a great moment that you trust implicitly, you're not going to win against the odds. What he said is right. He needs to build his reputation and get in and support whoever the Democratic nominee is, get a cabinet position and branch out, find his way there. Maybe he becomes the lieutenant governor. I don't know the Democrat, but I'm telling you, a 32-year-old kid, because I'm 44, okay? And that's a kid to me. I've been in this since I was 21 years old. If he thinks he's going to win, I don't give him $1 million, okay? I could spend that $1 million as efficiently as possible, and I bet you I still lose. Because that's a hard slog to make against an establishment that is the Democratic Party. And the unions are a machine. And you know what? That's just the way it works. That is politics, to be bluntly honest.
We can take one more question. Lindsay, it's up to you.
Okay. Our lucky winner.
I hate to piggyback on that, but I was at the Huntington Woods and Oak Park Democratic
Party. You have to first say your name and where you're retired
sorry.
From.
My name is Wendy Appleton, and I'm not retired.
I like your scarf.
Thank you. I'm a case manager for people who've been in automobile accidents. Mm-hmm. I work for the people, and I'm not retired and don't plan to. But to piggyback, I was at the Huntington Woods Oak Park Democratic Party meeting where Abdul spoke. He had everybody eating out of his hand.
Sure.
I have no doubt he's a smart, smart man.
I'm just saying that that's exactly what I'm glad that you brought it up, because I was just curious, because I realized NPR didn't really cover Bernie Sanders very well, in my opinion.
That's true.
As much as I love NPR.
He is a candidate who has captured the imagination of a lot of people who've watched him and, you know, I've also met with him, and you know, you see the same thing, that he's driven, he's ambitious. When the last round of fundraising numbers were coming out, I was trying to get an interview with another candidate, and they were out of pocket, and his campaign had him call me from where, you know, when he was on vacation in New York, that no one's going to work harder than him. You know, we'll see what that yields.
I would much rather have dinner with him than any of the others. Well, but
yeah, I just think it's interesting because Kennedy was president at 42 or 3.
43.
But his old man had a machine that was
right.
like
I'm just
no other.
It is possible, and that's all I'm saying.
You know, it's interesting. That's another, this is not speak to your question. There was another era when Kennedy was president at 43, the governor of Michigan was 35. The Attorney General of the state of Michigan was 37. We were a younger people back then.
We also died a lot earlier.
That's right. And I'd like to, first of all, I'd like to say two things. Number one, it's quite possible that any of us are wrong, or all of us are wrong, and if we are, you misheard us. And I really want, and I want all of us to thank all of you for giving up your evening for us. It was great. Thank you.